Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
John Williams in a cloudy studio. Actually, the studio is fine, but outside, whoo!
Mr. President, all we want are good jobs. They don't have to be in coal.
Sorry, hombre, it's all coal.
Lord have mercy.
In Trump's America, men work in two places, coal mines and Goldman Sachs.
Pretty good. I'll tell you what, Alec Baldwin does a good Donald Trump. He does a great Bill O'Reilly. I mean, he was better at Bill O'Reilly than he is at Donald Trump. I don't know if you saw that on Saturday night. We're kind of clicking around. I wasn't even sure if it was going to be a new show because they've been off for a couple of weeks with reruns. But he just nailed it. And when they did him interviewing him, that is O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor having President Trump on, and Alec Baldwin portrayed both of them, he was dynamite at that, and he was better. He was better at the Bill O'Reilly character than he was at the President Trump character. Our Trump talk always comes your way at 2 o'clock on this show when it is warranted. It usually is, right? So we always put that Trump at two. That's when we'll get to that conversation. John Williams here. Hope you had a good weekend. By the way, there's just a few events in the world that you should watch, even if you don't watch sports. The Masters is always one. I'll dial around when golf is on and kind of look at it a little bit. The scenes are pretty. The guys are great. But I'm just not a guy that will spend an afternoon watching golf. The Masters, I will. I was trying to get out of my apartment. I'm staying in a little place downtown. And I thought I'm going to go for a walk or a run or do something outside. It was nice yesterday. But then Sergio made that eagle. And you thought, wow, this is all of a sudden getting super interesting. I could not walk away from my TV. I couldn't get away from that. And then it goes to 19th hole. And
you know, John, it's an event unlike any other.
It really is.
I know it is.
Well, David Haas said there are some things. Are there any other things that finally need to happen in sports? We've been on a little run of them. The Cubs finally won the World Series. Northwestern finally got into the NCAA basketball tournament. Sergio, after 74 majors, wins not just any old major. He wins the Masters. Earth was rooting for Sergio. I don't know if there's any other events there that are still needing to happen. But that was just a lot of fun to watch. And I found myself so wrapped up in it, I thought, and this is me, not a golf guy.
Oh, I just love it. I love the Masters.
Do you watch golf regularly, though?
Sometimes, but not like, you know, the Masters is automatic, you know.
So,
and you want to pull for, you want to be really rooting for the guy. You know, he didn't quite get that walk up to the 18th green like a lot of the people who are going to win do.
Oh, for sure. Well, because you knew he was going to miss putts. Yeah. I mean, he was so good off the tee and so good off the fairway, and then he'd get to within 15 feet, and he had a little bit of the yips. And Justin Rose kind of missed a couple shots that he wants back as well. I mean, they both had a chance to win it and didn't.
You know, but it seems to me that the PGA has right now this cadre of just – supremely likable characters that I just enjoy, you know, not doing yard work on the weekends and watching them play.
Yeah.
Whether it's Ricky Fowler is, you know, another one, you just root for them.
There's a bunch of them, and I always used to think that when Tiger Woods went down, when he stopped being competitive or interesting, that golf just wouldn't be able to recapture that. Missing Tiger right now.
No, it's just the opposite, really, because it used to be one guy, and now it's 10, you know?
No, that's a good point. So you'd say the Masters would be one of those events a non-sports person should watch. The Indy 500. I love to watch the Indy 500. I love to watch the Daytona. Oh, now I'm gonna out myself. The Daytona 500 or Daytona 400?
No, it's 630.
The Daytona one where they go around the track real fast.
Daytona 742.
And then the NCAA tournament. I would put Wimbledon in that list, too.
Yep.
But you got to get up early for that.
Strawberries and cream.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, it's 1:14. Speaking of sports, I wanted to bring Danny Ecker into the show to talk a little bit about Cubs baseball and Mark Carmen, too. Danny, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
By the way, do you want to jump into that conversation?
Oh, just the things that you need to have that you're waiting to happen in sports?
Yeah. Well, do the one where if even you're not a sports fan, you should watch this sporting event because you'll enjoy it. What else should we add to that list? Anything come to mind?
Boy, I mean, you hit some of the big ones. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's some of those that I think some of the ones related to golf. I think honestly, not just the Masters, but some of the other major golf tournaments and the stories and the history. I think it's the kind of thing where you look at players that were playing 30 years ago when the players that they're competing with were, toddlers, I think is just a fascinating part of that. So
it is rare that you get that age range, yeah.
And so many moments, I mean, just the Thursday moment when Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus are teeing off.
Yeah.
Arnold Palmer isn't there,
The ceremony for that thing was touching, and I'm one to roll my eyes at. For instance, before a Bulls game, I think we could get that thing moving on a little more quicker than that. But I thought that was touching. Mark Carmen's on a line, too. Hey, Carm, how are you?
Hi, John. Good to be here. The best sporting event that I've ever been to, and I'm a big tennis guy, but the U.S. Open in New York, taking the 7 train out to Flushing Meadows and walking in there, that's an experience I hope that everyone should have.
Really? I've never done that, and I like tennis, but that's a good one?
Well, you can, you go the first week, and you can buy the grounds pass, and you're sitting in the third row for, player number 8 in the world taking on player number 32. So, you don't have to, you're not sitting up top. You're sitting right there, and you can just appreciate how good these guys are. Even if you're not a diehard tennis fan, just the casual person who goes out there, it's just a whole other level where you can sit. And by the way, the food and the drink's excellent too, John.
I've heard that about the U.S. Open. Mark Carmen from WGN Radio and Danny Ecker, who is the sports business reporter at Crain's Chicago Business. How will the Cubs experience be different this year, guys? That's why I asked you both to jump in here. Carm, are you over there right now?
I'm not there quite yet, John. I thought I would be, but I'm not. But I think, for me, there's a couple things that are extremely interesting that I'm wondering about how they'll play out. In the past, you could walk up to Wrigley, right, and you could buy a ticket on the street, perhaps. Nowadays, the Cubs are not allowing you in on the print-at-home tickets. So all those white sheets of paper printed off on StubHub that you would see scalpers with, they're not there anymore. So I'm just kind of curious how that will play out for somebody who lives in the neighborhood or just likes to go down there hoping to get a little bit more of a bargain than you'll get online or at the window. I think that's a huge change. So I'm not exactly sure how that will play out. And, the other just like functional change to me is that, they've added another exit along with the park. So, down the left field line, rather than that huge gridlock getting out of there, I'm assuming it's going to be a lot easier to get in and out of Wrigley Field, which I think fans are obviously going to love.
Boy, they needed that. How about you, Danny? What do you think the Cubs fans will notice differently at Wrigley this year?
Well, the biggest thing is there's an entirely new plaza that just didn't exist until today. It wasn't open until just this morning. And this is, something that is going to totally transform the experience of, showing up at a game, being there before and after. Unfortunately, during games, it's actually going to be only open to people that are at, that have a game ticket. So it's going to function like a giant patio. It's like an extension to the ballpark. Hmm. But, it's going to really transform the area around the park and, you're making more of a day of it if you want to go early or stay late and hang out in the plaza. I think that's going to be probably the biggest thing that fans will notice. And what Mark mentioned about the tickets thing, I mean, cannot be understated. That is a huge change that the Cubs are making, forcing people to either use the ballpark app, and do digital tickets on their phone, mobile tickets, or, get the hard stock traditional tickets, and they like to say that it's all about preventing counterfeiting, but it's really trying to control the secondary market and saying, okay, well, you can't just go out and resell your tickets anywhere. At this point, you can only resell them through the Cubs secondary site or StubHub, which is a Cubs partner. So,
what do we think about that?
Really,
I guess I could change the cardstock ticket with you. The if I have a regular ticket, I could sell you that on the street, right?
You still can. So that's still, I mean, but it's just those are not necessarily as prevalent as the so it's such an easy thing to post the print at home version or post if you go on any basically what the change does, it makes every other secondary website that's not StubHub effectively the same as Craigslist, where if you actually want to coordinate a sale, you have to either find a way to mail someone your hard stock tickets or meet up with them somewhere to give it to them or give them your password to actually get it through the ballpark app. So it's a really interesting move.
Carm, what do people like you say about that?
I don't like it, John. I think it's, you know, you're making it harder and harder on a little guy who's, you know, trying to get some value going to a game. I mean, Cubs tickets are extremely expensive these days. And there are built-in bargains, you know, the Bronze games that are in April, three of them coming up next week, where you can get in for $9 and sit up top. But, again, I mean, it's a Monday night in April. That's not exactly ideal conditions to go to a game. So I just think sometimes, you know, you're just not letting the market actually dictate what they're worth. And for years, I mean, Cubs seats, when they were doing the rebuild, were worth about, you know, one-fifth of their actual face value. You know, they're probably priced appropriately. Because it's still, you know, a very, very long baseball season. You know, the actual market for tickets getting upgraded doesn't really happen until the playoffs and, you know, occasional Saturday games throughout the year. Let me throw one more thing in there, John. You know, they're building this American Airlines 1914 club underneath home plate. So your diehard season ticket holders who have had them for years in section 19, 20, 21, these are premium seats. But all those fans, unless you wanted to upgrade to $400 a ticket seats, they got moved out of those seats. They had three choices, either the left field corner low down or the right field corner or back a section. So it's really getting more and more corporate. I mean, that's just the reality of what's going on. And I think down the line, the upper deck seats, 419, 420 right behind, that's going to be another whole corporate area where they're going to price the fans who have had those seats out forever. So there are, like, hidden values and hidden games, but there's also going to be a lot more corporate feel to the park going forward.
I guess my question for both of you then is it too expensive? I mean, everybody's tickets went up in price. Talk to me a little bit about that. I've got a couple of other transportation questions for you guys, too. I'm just asking a couple of smart fellas here what the expectation is for you when you go to Wrigley this year. Costs, menu, the ballpark, stuff like that. You've got a question or comment? 312-981-7200 WGN. Well, hopefully they're going to get the game in. It's just now starting to rain on Michigan Avenue. We're in the Allstate Showcase studio, and it looks like it's going to rain a lot, and now it's just starting to rain. Will they get the game in tonight? We'll keep you posted, but it doesn't look certain. On the phone line is Danny Ecker. He's over at Crane Chicago Business, reports on the business of sports, and Mark Carmen, who just yaps about it. And I asked the two guys to come on with us and talk to us a little bit about
Danny, who's an authority, and then you got Mark, so that's good.
He's listening, Steve.
Oh, sorry.
His phone line is on. Mark, I'm sorry you had to hear that.
I'm used to that from Bertrand. It's, you know, just
par for the course. Hey, Danny, so what else fan experience-wise? I was thinking ticket prices, but maybe people have already factored that in, or maybe not. Maybe you don't feel it until you actually start going to the games, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a lot more expensive. That's what you get to do when you're the Cubs and you win the World Series, you know, raise their ticket prices by about 20%. And, you know, Mark was saying before the break, you know, it really is unfortunate for people who maybe have been there for 30 years at a certain section, and especially that part behind the park, behind home plate. And then they're going to get moved unless they want to pay triple the price because they're putting in this new club. You know, that's tough, but you know, the truth is that these ticket price decisions are based on what the market can bear.
Yeah.
And if you just look at the secondary market, you know, you're either going to be paying the money on the secondary market or paying the Cubs. The Cubs want to make sure you're putting money in their pocket.
I totally get that. I understand organizations' desire to capture that money. Why should the scalp? It's in a way, it's the rooftop conversation, right? That's our product. Why do we let you capitalize on it?
Right. And look, it's at their own risk, certainly. I mean, you always look at the risk of having empty seats because you make them too corporate. I mean, look, if you look at Yankee Stadium and you look at the seats behind home plate, there's a lot of empty seats.
The reason why, more often than not,
is that they're corporate-owned seats that may or may not get used. People are maybe watching the game, not really there to watch. They're just there to entertain clients. I mean, the Cubs are certainly taking the risk of that bad optics of having some empty seats.
I hate that. Well, let me ask Mark this. Mark, is there any pushback? I mean, maybe I'm late to this conversation, but how do Cubs fans generally feel about the team cashing in on all of that?
I mean, I think that the diehard season ticket holders have had some pushback. I know a bunch of them have been calling Cubs personnel and have been complaining and feeling like they had paid for an inferior product for years, and then all of a sudden they get good, and it's great that they're good. I mean, don't get me wrong here, obviously. But then they had a huge bump up in prices last year, you know, close to 20%. So I think a lot of people feel like they were paying for the rebuild, and now, you know, the Cubs along the way were saying that, hey, we're not going to, you know, bump up our prices huge. But then that's, of course, what ended up happening. And I know that a lot of people also are interested in parking, John. You know, with all the rehab and the new building coming in, is it going to be easier to park? And I think the answer to that is going to be not much. I mean, most of the lots are four-season ticket holders, and there are some cash lots. The green lot on Grace has some cash pricing as well. So, and that thing has been expanded. So there are, but, it, you know, it's also, it's just, you know, the Cubs, will, I think, will always continue to encourage people who are coming to the games to take public transportation or to park in their free lot at 3900 North Rockwell, where they have the shuttle bus that will take you down there, which is, you know, if you're driving from the suburbs, that's a good option.
Well, Danny, would you say that if the seats are filled, then they're not overpricing it? If the seats are filled, then the fans are happy.
Well, I mean, it depends what segment of the fans, you know. I mean, certainly
No, fans are fans. I mean,
there's enough
I don't know. Maybe the Cubs shouldn't care about the. I mean, you got what 40,000 people in the ballpark. You got millions watching at home. But I mean,
okay. Look at it long term though, John. You've got 8-year-olds who can't go to a ball game anymore.
Yeah.
Right, and they're the ones who are going to have to carry the team in 25 years or 30 years.
Maybe they'll become Sox fans, right? Because they can get in, they can have a hot dog, they can enjoy the experience.
Well, here's
the other thing, too, guys.
Go ahead, Danny.
I would just add that, you know, you also need, you know, certain demographics and certain people in the stands, because that's really what a lot of sponsors who pay for signage at the stadium pay for. You know, they want to get in front of a certain audience, and that's, you know, you need to be able to put people in seats and, you know, actually watching some of these ads and seeing all the, getting all exposure to all the different brands that are paying a lot of money to be affiliated with the Cubs. So, you know, that's also valuable to the team.
Yeah. Hey, Danny, it's nice to talk to you. You and I haven't visited on this show since I've been back, but I'm going to call you again. You're terrific. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Anytime. Thanks a lot, John.
And Mark, you and I have visited many times. There's a joke here, but I'm not even going to tell it.
Always a pleasure, King John. Thank you for having me on Cubs home opening day.
Yeah, no kidding. Hopefully they get to play. In fact, that's what we're talking about next. News, traffic, weather on WGN. By the way, Steve, wouldn't it be a shame if somebody came a long distance for the Cubs game today and then it got rained out?
Yeah, well,
I know they have a rain day, but I mean, you know, you schedule your life around these things.
Especially this year.
What if you came from, Hawaii? Say you flew in from Hawaii for the game.
Well, you would be going home to Hawaii.
The young lady sitting next to me, hi, what's your name?
My name is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how long have you and I known each other?
It's got to be at
20
least
years?
About, probably around there.
Graduated from Northwestern University, right? Or went to school there?
Yeah, I went to Northwestern.
And then now live in Hawaii, but stay in touch with Minnesota, that's my other life. Chicago, better than a lot of Chicagoans. You've come here for today's Cubs game.
We came for the opener.
And you're going to be there for the ring ceremony
game. And the ring ceremony.
And you're going to the Blackhawks.
And the Blackhawks playoff game.
Blackhawks won't get rained out. I know that. Wow. Wow. I want to be you someday. How are you? It's good to see you.
We're good. Oh. It would be better if it weren't pouring right now.
I know.
Well, it's a momentary thing. We'll be fine.
Yeah. What do you think, Steve? What are we thinking about the first pitch?
Well, I'm no expert, so I would say that there might be a storm or something pass through, but I don't think it's going to be an all-day rain.
So we think they're going to play tonight.
Right.
That's,
I mean,
the thought?
I was just in Hawaii a couple weeks ago, right? That's what happens. It rains, then it
clears
up.
See, this
is
Chicago or Minnesota. It's somewhere in the Midwest. I know that.
It passes through, clears up, we'll be fine.
All right. More on the weather from a more authoritative source on that in a minute.
I'm still here.
Chrissy, it's nice to see you.
It's great to see you. Welcome back, John.
Yeah, it's nice of you. It's nice of you to say that. She's been listening to us from Hawaii. So when you listen to us in Hawaii, what's the time lag?
It's on in the morning for us.
When you get up.
Yeah, well, I'm at work already, but like you're on at 8 o'clock in the morning there.
I'm your morning drive show.
Yeah, pretty much.
I should give traffic and weather on the 8s and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Chrissy, it's nice to see you both. Thanks for coming in.
Aloha.
Aloha. Speaking of travel, so here's the story, Steve. People are talking about it. You know what it is. It's the couple that were going on United Airlines from Chicago to Louisville. And I have so much to learn about airline ticketing. I've known, for instance, that if they oversell, and airlines overbook, never completely understood that, but if they overbook, then there, before you actually go on the plane, they say, we have vouchers. And if anybody wants the voucher, then we'll give you the voucher. You'll stay overnight or you'll fly later today and we'll give you $400. And that was the offer to the people. But they didn't offer them that in the area before they went on the plane. They offered them that on the plane. The plane was full. It was booked. It was overbooked. And they had some people from United who had to get to Louisville, people that work for the airlines, maybe a crew or something. So somebody's going to get bumped off this plane. But they were figuring that out after everybody was already in their seats. So the people are on their seats, and they come over the intercom, and they say, okay, does anybody want to take $400? We'll put you up at the Best Western, and we'll get you a nice bowl of chili. So they all say no. Everybody's just sitting there, sitting there, sitting there. We've all been to this movie, but usually we're sitting there in the gate area. We're not actually on the plane. So then they up it to $800. They say, okay, $800. And nobody bites. That's such a kind of uncomfortable feeling, but you don't have to. You don't have to be that stand-up guy. You want to get to Louisville. And $800 is a lot of money. But you really want to get to Louisville. And you're not losing anything necessarily, because you're just getting what you paid for, and you don't have to take this offer. Nobody took them up on it. They said, okay, now, what's round three? This is where it gets interesting. Round three is in $1,200. I'll bet if they'd gone to $2,500, folks would have got on their phones and said, Dad, happy birthday, we're not going to be there. You know, the folks would have dealt with it, but they didn't. The people said no. The person on the intercom of the plane said, okay, now we're randomly going to select. And if your name comes up, you will automatically be kicked off. And they needed four seats. The first two came up, and the couple got up and got walked off. They do it again, and now this guy's like, nope, I'm not getting off the plane. I paid for it. I'm on the plane. I'm not getting off the plane. Here's what happened after that. What they're doing is dragging him off the plane. So cops and security, they get on the plane and they drag this guy off. Now, none of this would have happened if they just would have done this before everybody was seated, but they didn't. So that's their bad. They drag. I mean, literally, you can see his belly. He's on his butt and back. They've got his hands and they're just pulling him like a sack of potatoes off that airplane. And the people are outraged and upset because it's very upsetting to see. The question is, who's the real bad here? Is it the airline and the cops and the security people for dragging this poor man off? Or is it this guy because, dude, this sucks, but you lost. And I got no time for your shenanigans on airplanes. We're all nervous enough as it is. I'll go first. This is 100% on the passenger. I'm sorry. You got to get off the airplane. You have to get off the airplane right now. It's going to be upsetting when we drag you off. You're not going to like it. I was talking to Pete McMurray earlier this morning, and he said, what do you think? I go, $100,000. You know, Pete and I like to play the how much is this incident worth game. And Pete said, yeah, I think this is six figures. And then I paused and I thought, wait a minute. The airline really did screw up here. But I don't think at the end of the day, it was a mistake that can't be fixed. Here's the fix. You get off the airplane. And he didn't get off the airplane. I've changed my mind on this. I'll give him $6. I mean, really, he should get a voucher. He should get a night at a Best Western. Give him a steak and a nice bottle of wine at the Olive Garden near the Best Western. But other than that, I don't think he's got much of a case. You have to get off the airplane. My number is 312-981-7200. Where are you on this one? This is WGN.
Super Duper Airlines, now featuring super duper low rates and even better super duper good deals if we got to throw you off the plane. You want some of that?
I want some super low rates to Louisville, please.
Louisville, super. I get you there for $98.
$98, that's great.
Plus taxes, fees, security charges, big charges, pass-throughs, gas taxes, pass gases, snack surcharge, party add-ons. It comes to 146. You want some of that?
$98 to Louisville comes to
146.
What happens if you guys are overbooked?
Well, as you may have heard, we offer you a $400 voucher and an overnight stay at the lovely Best Western on Airport Road, overlooking the beautiful Super America.
And if no one takes you up on that offer?
Which is hard to imagine, right? You know they serve booze in those vending machines now.
Right.
I can't imagine anyone saying no to a $400 voucher and a night in a Best Western, rosé wine in a vending machine, free cable and Wi-Fi, right? I mean, you're flying into Louisville anyway. Louisville. That ain't that much better, right?
But if no one says yes to that deal?
Hey, my honeymoon wasn't that good, okay?
Please don't tell me about your honeymoon.
It was me and Carl. We spent 2 days at the track with his cousin Tony playing the pony. We got a coupon for free ribs at the buffet at the track.
Getting back to my tickets to Louisville.
Slept at the new Econo Lodge near the stables. Let me tell you, a free night at the airport would be an upgrade.
Right.
Plus, at the airport, there'd be a lot more takeoffs and landings than Carl and I had that night.
The conversation went on like that for a while. It's 151. This is WGN. John Williams here. Super Duper Airlines. It's the one I usually fly. All right, let's pick up a couple of phone lines here. We're talking about what happened on that United flight, or actually the United not flight. Mike, you're on the air. What do you want to say? Hi.
Hey, John. One of the TV stations reported that gentleman was a doctor, physician, and he needed to be back the next day for professional reasons.
Yeah, that's what he said.
I think that trumps what the other ones are. Plus, they were flying airline personnel to another place.
Yeah, I know. I wish we didn't know either of those facts. But I'm not sure. First of all, I'm not sure that he was a doctor. I don't know. Maybe he was. Maybe he wasn't. I don't know that the airline wants to get into the business of deciding whose job is more important than whose. I'm a talk show host. I need to be on the air at 10 to talk about the Cubs.
But you did hear that, right? They clarified that it was a Republic crew that they needed to get down to Louisville for another flight.
Well, that's why I'm with the airlines on this. I mean, they handled it badly, letting everybody get seated. That was the biggest mistake.
Right, right.
Don't you think, Mike? Yeah. I mean, if this had been handled in the lobby,
well,
it wouldn't.
They also had to clear the plane to clean the blood. So everybody had to get off again.
Oh, I didn't catch that. The guy was bleeding as a result of the manhandling?
Yes. Blood was coming from his mouth. If you look at the video.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Really? You got to skid everybody off and wipe down the plane for that?
Yes.
Wow.
And then he tried to get back on, and he grabbed onto something else again. I don't know.
See, this is a guy you do not want to have on your plane. All right, so where are you on this, Mike? Whose side are you on?
I think the passenger's correct.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Hey, Mike, thanks for the extra details. I knew that he said he was a surgeon, but I'm always that I use that all the time when I'm trying to get an upgrade or get into a restaurant and I can't get in. I say I'm a surgeon.
Dr. Williams, Dr. John Williams.
I really need a good seat because I've got to operate tomorrow and you just can't have me cranky. Let's talk to Joyce. Hey, Joyce, this is John. You're on the air.
Hi, John. This is Joyce. I started traveling a lot, and this actually just started happening to us 3 times. One was the last time was from Hawaii to L.A. They asked 6 people to get off the plane, and they said, if nobody volunteers, we'll give you an $800 voucher, then we're going to see who came on the plane, the last 6 people, and we're going to take you off.
Really?
But this is the reason. It's not of overbooking. Really, it's a weight problem. The plane has something that tells them when the plane is overweight, and it's like a dangerous thing to be overweight and flying. So that's why they want you off.
But you're not walking onto a scale. How do they know how much you weigh?
I don't know, Steve. They're not lying about this. I'm sure they got a way to know how much is in the cargo hold.
Steve, they have something that tells them when they turn on the plane what the plane has on is a load with luggage.
The plane taxis onto a giant scale.
I'm just skeptical.
And then the lady has to open up her suitcase and, because she had 52 pounds in her bag.
Was that an eclair you had for breakfast, ma'am?
Joyce, that's really helpful. Thank you for calling. Let's talk to Frank. Hey, Frank, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, John. I travel enough to know that if the flight is overbooked, then the airline personnel will come on the aircraft intercom and say, ladies and gentlemen, we have a full flight. If there's anyone who has a flexible travel schedule, we have some people that would like to get on. nobody stands up and just say, oh, sure, somebody else wants to get on, I'll get on.
No, I get
that. But the moment that they say we're going to offer a $500 travel voucher in addition to hotel accommodations, then people say, oh, sure, I can get off. But I think the airline was in the wrong. They called the police, and the police used abusive force when it really wasn't necessary. This shouldn't have happened. It just should have happened.
But when the cops come on that plane, you got to get off. I mean, the cops aren't going to try and cajole you, and you refuse, and then they walk away. When the cops come on the plane,
you ever heard a television commercial? Ladies and gentlemen, just in the event we need your seat, we're going to bump you off. And if you don't get out of your seat, we're going to use excessive force.
I never see that. No, that is generally not how they advertise.
Either a radio spot or a television spot. It's Louisville, Kentucky. You know what they should have done?
No.
They should have used the company van and drive those employees.
The employees, yeah. Or it sucks for the people in Louisville because the crew couldn't get there, but this guy paid for that ticket. That's an interesting point. Thanks, Frank.
I'm sorry, John, but I am told that on the wheel apparatus that they do have a gauge.
Well, that's what Joyce said, Steve, that there is a way to weigh.
You're right. I'm sorry, Joyce. I would like to take that back. I apologize.
How dare you, doubt the veracity of Joyce?
You're the one that said they pulled on a giant scale.
Hey, Mike, you're on WGN. What's your thought?
John, you're wrong on this one. Say I booked my flight 2 months ahead of time or 3 months ahead of time. And then, what we're saying, these people just had to get this other crew to another. That is not my problem. I booked it, and now to have the police come and physically take a person off who paid for their ticket, and how about if I did have some kind of emergency or I had to get back into town? I mean, come on. And the airline does know when they overbook.
Yeah, I know. I hate that, too. I mean, the flights seem to be more full these days. Mike, I got to cut you off. I got to go. I want to get in one more phone call before I do because it's Dave Plyer and I got 20 seconds. Hey, Dave.
John, how you doing, buddy?
I don't know. I thought every now and then I think there's a parade behind me, Dave. I turn around, ain't nobody there. What's up, man?
Well, I got to tell you, I literally travel once or twice a week, and I've been doing it since the beginning of the year. And I'm going to say 85% of the flights that I've been on have been overbooked. I think that is the bigger problem. They want to fill that plane as best they can. And then you're always asked, we don't have enough room for your luggage. We don't have any room for any of your bags. And, oh, by the way, we need 4 people, 3 people, 2 people, every single flight. Now, I haven't seen anyone removed from a flight before because someone has always gotten off the flight. But, I mean, you paid for the ticket. You show loyalty to that airline by flying them over anybody else. And then you're told you got to leave. It just doesn't make sense to me. I really am with the passenger on this one.
Nice to hear you, Dave. Thanks for calling, man.
Thanks, buddy.
And by the way, next time you call, if you agree with me, I'll put you on even longer.
I'll tell Elephant next time.
Right. Use that. Thank you, Steve Bertram. Raining, but not too hard on Michigan Avenue right now. 7 o'clock, we should be okay.
Here's what I think Assad's telling Trump. F you. If you're an adversary of the United States and you don't worry about what Trump may do on any given day, you're crazy.
I think he is. It's 2:11. This is John Williams. We'll talk a little bit about that in this half hour. Also, in this half hour, we'll keep our eye on the weather for you if anything changes. Then in the next half hour, we'll talk about that story that we mentioned briefly last week, and that is that there's a company that wants to make edible snacks out of bugs. Think about that. There's a limitless supply. They're probably healthy for you. And if they tasted good, you know, you never feel bad about eating them. Bugs, they're already there. So they've got like a Southwest Ranch mix of crickets.
It's a crispy ranch.
And I haven't seen them yet. We're going to talk to them. I don't know if they look like bugs or do they change the position and shape of them. I mean, like when you have chicken tenders, those don't really look like anything you've seen on a chicken, but you're cool with that. So what if you had a little snack and they said, well, that's actually, you know, roasted roaches and crickets and it's all protein. It's all good. It's fiber. I'll bet there's a lot of fiber in a cricket. So let's just eat some of those. It'll be after 2:30. Joel Ostrow joins us now, political science professor at Benedictine University. He's joined us many times over the years. He's an expert on particularly all things Russia, but the international affairs as they affect the United States as well. Joel, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great, and it's great to have you back in, on WGN regularly, John. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's nice of you to say that.
I got to tell you, I want to echo your comment on subscribing to newspapers. I think it's a really important point, and that's a great quote you had by Senator Graham.
Yeah. Well, he's funny because he's a Republican, I think.
Yeah.
He says some of the that's a guy who does not need Donald Trump's vote to get reelected. He's always been very interesting to me. He's great fodder on the talk shows. He's very funny, but he also, I think, makes about as much sense as any of them of either stripe. I don't know, Steve, do you agree? Are you a fan of Lindsey Graham? Do you think that he's good for the dialogue? I do. What's your take on him, Joel?
Well, shortly after the election, oddly enough, I sent him a letter that began, I'm the last person I would ever thought would be sending you a letter of praise. But his courage and his principle in standing up to Trump during the campaign and afterwards is really singular among elected Republicans. And I praised him strongly in that. And you know, I don't agree with most of his politics, but you sure got to admire the guy.
I'm not even sure what he's saying here, though. What is his point? He said, here's what I think Assad's telling Trump by flying from the base, the one that we bombed FU, and I think he's making a serious mistake. In other words, Graham is saying, don't play chicken with Donald Trump, right, or you'll lose. Isn't that the point?
I think the point is that this administration has no clear strategy. They're flying by the seat of their pants. You know, on Monday, the Secretary of State comes out with a statement that makes it look like, you know, we're okay with Assad. We'll have to find a way to work with him. You know, we're no longer looking to remove him or punish Syria. 2 days later, this happens. You know, I think they're banking on not only the inexperience of the president and the people around him, but also the fundamental lack of clear direction and objective. And it's a challenge. I don't think it's an FU. I think it's an, oh, yeah, let's see what you got.
Which is such a juvenile game to play, it seems to me. I mean, now we're sort of floating around North Korea saying the same sort of thing, tempting them. And listen, we don't have to cow to anybody. We are the United Flipping States. We are the big dog, and we wear the white hat. And I believe that and always will. I believe that today. But I don't see the point of tempting some of these dum-dums either.
Well, I now I see what you're saying. It's a little bit different. I think that what Assad is looking at is, okay, he says we're okay, we're going to go through with our objectives, and Russia clearly, that's working closely with the Assad regime, is sort of banking on, you know, exploiting, you know, the reactive and lack of focus nature of our foreign policy right now. Also understanding that we don't have really strong allies in terms of foreign policy because nobody knows what our goals or objectives are, what we're doing.
Yeah.
There is no foreign policy where there are no foreign policy objectives.
Well, I want to ask you this, Joel. Hold on. It's 2:16 on WGN. If you've got a question or comment, we'll be happy to weave you in. 312-981-7200. New York Times and CNN are writing about this today, too. The New York Times headline is Tillerson on eve of Russia trip takes hard line on Syria. And CNN had this as the opening sentence. The United States will hold to account any government that commits atrocities against innocent people, Rex Tillerson said Monday, as key U.S. allies met to work out a common stance on Syria. I'm not sure what that means. We're going to hold to account, those are his words, countries that commit atrocities against innocent people. So if we see the Iranians or the North Koreans gassing their own people, are we going to do the same thing then, Joel? Is that the message here?
Or even more ominously, you know, the current regime in Moscow that puts bullet in the back of the head of any investigative journalist, journalists who are critical of Putin and the corruption and violence of his administration, imprison or murder opposition politicians, or those who would try to fund or support political groupings not aligned with Vladimir Putin. Those are atrocities against freedom, against liberty, against human rights. It's atrocities against private property, against a free press, against all the things that we are supposed to hold dear prior to, you know, the first week of November. Anyway, as a state with a clear constitution and truths that we say we hold to be self-evident, it's not clear that at least our political leaders hold those truths to be self-evident, and so the world doesn't know what we're going to do. That's fluff, that statement, and you know, no administration responds everywhere to all atrocities. It's not the correct role of any government nor ours.
Well, was it the right response for us in the case of Syria? They gassed their people. That violates every convention in the world. Were we right to launch missiles at that airfield?
It is not wrong to respond, but the question is, what is the appropriate response? An appropriate response would be much more effective if it was not just the United States launching missiles, but the United States in coordination with our allies, with NATO, with other governments, not just NATO, but, you know, Japan and China.
Okay, but say that the French and the
coordinating
British.
Coordinating with Russia.
What if they had,
much
though?
Much more of a power.
Well, what if it was a coordinated effort? At the end of the day, they gassed their people. Those beautiful babies died horrible deaths. The United States responded with military force. I think late last week, most people thought that was good. They felt good about this. They called our bluff, and we gave it to them. We're not going to stand by.
That's not enough. Yes, we feel good about it. But that's not the objective of foreign policy, or ought not to be the only objective in foreign policy. Our objective as the United States ought to be to effect an outcome that is advantageous, ultimately, not only to the United States, but to the principles that we hold as important. And that only happens when it's not just, okay, we feel good now, we can look at something else. It's we're doing this together, and we can go to the UN, and we can go to the Security Council, and we can work with states, including those who aren't our closest friends. But we can work with others because this is an outrageous act. And we can work with others to even pressure Russia, which, you know, seems to have failed in its obligations on the agreement about removing and eliminating serious chemical weapons. But we have no infrastructure to do that now because we have an administration that lacks really a foreign policy team. You look at the National Security Council, you look at the upper echelons of the State Department, including the Secretary of State, and positions are vacant or absent people with foreign policy expertise. We have some generals and lieutenant generals in various positions, but we don't have foreign policy expertise. And the president, you know, his top foreign policy advisor is his son-in-law, who has zero experience.
You know, everybody's been looking at that picture of the team, the 19 people that were in the room. It was reminiscent of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and their people looking at the screen when they were watching in real time that operation that took out, now the name escapes me. And so now we have the similar version of that, Trump and his people all sitting there looking at that. Sean Spicer in the corner, and Rex Tillerson was in the room. But very close to the president at the time was Jared Kushner. And I don't know how much he participated in that, but I thought, this is a young man who is into real estate. I kind of don't even want him in the room. There's only so much oxygen in there. Why is he in there? And Lord, what role is he playing? Okay, let me pause here. A lot of questions for our guest and comments, too, and that can be you as well. We have one phone line open. Joel Ostro is on the line, poli-sci prof over at Benedictine University and an expert on Russia and foreign affairs. You can join us on WGN. What percentage of us think that the United States did the right thing in the case of bombing Syria's airfield? 51% back the U.S. strike on Syria. But most are concerned with our relations with Russia, according to a recent poll. That's why we reached out to Joel Ostro. He's a professor of political science at Benedictine University. This is his cup of tea. Lots of calls for you, Joel. So if you don't mind, yeah, I'll just jump in and take some questions from our listeners.
Sounds good.
Let's start with Tom. You're on WGN. Hey, Tom, what can we do for you?
Hi, John. Thunder and lightning is still out here in your old neighborhood.
Whereabouts?
Western Springs.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for the heads up on that, man.
At any rate, Professor, do you think that Nikki Haley is kind of like the canary in the mine for whatever policy is out there. She seems to be a star on the rise, and she seems to be kind of saying things at the UN that nobody else is saying in terms of being hard-nosed.
Yeah, it's interesting. Those who follow partisan politics, she's an interesting person to watch because this gives her a foreign policy credential she didn't have before. It has seemed in the first couple of months that she has taken a line that at least her boss has not publicly taken. I hadn't considered whether the canary in the coal mine idea, that she would be the one floating an idea and then see how it runs. It's possible. I don't really know enough about her background to know for sure, but it's not impossible. But I suspect that she's more of an independent voice trying to not only carve out a place for herself, but also to try and provide some direction for U.S. foreign policy. I have a sense from the little I do know about her that she's sort of the patriot who cares kind of personality. So.
Yeah, she does come across that way. It's a great question, Tom. Thanks for jumping in here. But I was thinking about this on Sunday when they all fan out to the different shows. And communication has been an issue for this administration. And I thought, are you guys all on the same page? Was there a conference call and did somebody, maybe the Secretary of State, say, everybody reflect this? Or did the president say, here's the talking points or papers? I don't know how that goes, but you'd like to think we're speaking with one voice on this and not you try that and you try that and let's see what works best.
Maybe, but I doubt from this administration so far that it's the Secretary of State who would be putting out that message. He's the least likely. But
who should? Who would be the person, Joel?
Oh, should is a different, every administration has a different leading voice on foreign policy, right? And it's not always the Secretary of State, In the Nixon administration, it was Kissinger. It didn't matter what role Kissinger held, right? Sometimes it's the National Security Advisor. Sometimes it's someone else. But it's always someone who's got some reason to be the voice on foreign policy, right? Could it be? I doubt it would be General Mattis, the Defense Secretary. It's hard to know.
Right.
And too often you hear different voices, which is what leads us to the conclusion that this is an administration without a rudder when it comes to foreign policy.
This is Gary. You're on WGN. Jump in there, Gary. What do you want to say?
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
My name's Gary Lawson, and my uncle is Ted Lawson. He was in the Doolittle raid on Japan.
What's your question, Gary?
Well, I don't have a question. I have a statement I'd like to make. President Trump is like a loose cannon, and I think that is what we've been needing for years and years in our presidency since Kennedy. He cocked the hammer back on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he put things back to normal. Okay, well, President Trump, he didn't just cock the hammer. He shot the gun, and he let the rest of the Middle East and the Far East and Russia know that he's a loose cannon, and I think that we got respect from that. And I think I'm gung-ho on that. I appreciate the fact that he did that. For the first time in 8 years, I'm proud to be an American, and I want to condone President Trump for doing what he did.
Thank you, Gary. I'm going to go from you to Dan. You're on WGN. Dan, you're my last call. What do you want to say?
Yeah, well, first of all, I disagree with your previous caller because before he bombed Syria, he warned the Russians
to get out of the way.
Right, and so they made precautions, and he didn't even bomb the runways at the airport. But my main point is one of the main themes Trump campaigned on was defeating ISIS, and I think one of the reasons he had friendly overtures for Russia and Syria was they would help in defeating ISIS. I think this whole situation puts a kink on that whole objective or a major obstacle, and I want to know what your guest's viewpoint on that is.
Interesting question. Let's wrap it up here, Joel. What's your thought about that?
Yeah, well, that would be a good objective, and certainly candidate Trump was clear that was going to be an objective. It's not quite clear how to do it. He never articulated a plan, and in office there's been no evidence
Well, remember, if he told us what the plan was, then everybody would know.
There's no evidence that it's a priority or that there's a consistent effort towards building. You know, we can't do it on our own. So where's the evidence that we're doing it with anyone else? You know, to the other point, you know, I don't respect a loose cannon. I you know, it kind of terrifies me. And if you're on the side of the cannon that's loose, you're at a lot of risk. So that's number one. The second point is, well, thank goodness we warned Russians who were on the ground before firing those cruise missiles, because the last thing you want is to be killing Russian soldiers if you're the United States of America right now. So
it's 2:32. Hey, Joel, I'm going to call you again probably, I don't know, over the next 4, 8 years, 2 years, however long this thing runs. But we'll be in touch.
Anytime.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Anytime. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. 2:40. Raining pretty good downtown. It's been on and off. John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue. Appreciate you tuning in. I'm on weekdays from 1 to 3. You can hear me Saturdays from 10 a.m. till noon. Muhammad Afshar's on a phone line. I was reading an article about his company in the Wall Street Journal the other day. He and his team won a million-dollar business challenge on food insecurity. If you say, all right, the globe has to feed all of these people, 1 in 9 humans live on less than $2 a day. How can we feed all of these people nutritionally? And so they took it up, and they won the challenge, and he's come up with an interesting way to feed people, and that's we all eat insects. But you know what? The market for that is over $500,000. Soon it'll be $750 million. And I think that's just in the U.S. alone. Muhammad Afshar is on a phone line, and he joins us on WGN. Hi, Muhammad. It's John Williams. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. You're based in Texas, right?
That's right, in Austin.
You were going to grow up and be a doctor someday, and then you thought, I could help more people if I do this. Is that it?
That's exactly right.
Huh. This being what? So what is it that you're trying to do, Muhammad?
So actually, I came across this when I was in medical school. There was this competition called the Hope Prize, $1 million to come up with a for-profit business that at its very core addresses a major global challenge. And that challenge was food security. And as you alluded in your opening remarks, it's something that's going to be the single biggest challenge that's going to affect the next generation on this planet, with 2 more billion people coming online. And so we came across this notion, or not notion, but really a fact, that insects are already consumed in 80% of the world's countries by nearly 2 billion people. And in fact, the challenge is not even a challenge of demand, it's actually a problem of supply. Insects are seasonally available, which means they're hand-harvested and very expensive. If you were to go to Mexico in the southern state of Oaxaca and buy 1 kilogram of grasshoppers, it would cost you $40 U.S., which is more expensive than beef, chicken, and pork combined. So our innovation was to come up with a way to farm insects on a year-round basis so that we can actually reduce significantly the cost of production and universalize access to this extraordinary source of protein, which also happens to be impressively sustainable.
So you're not catching these in the wild. You're growing them fresh, huh?
That's correct. Exactly.
Wow. So you got a cricket farm, do you?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. We have two. We have one that we had initially set up 2 years ago, and where we more or less developed a lot of our insights and operational excellence, as you would call it, with respect to insect farming. And we just finished constructing what will be the first fully automated insect farm in North America here in Austin, Texas.
What do they eat?
So we currently feed them a modified chicken starter feed that's USDA organic feed comprised of organic corn as the main sort of nutrition input. They consume at an impressive feed conversion efficiency of 1.7 to 1. So for those of your listeners who don't know what that means, a typical cow requires 20 pounds of feed to give you just 1 pound of edible beef, which is extraordinarily inefficient. With boiler chickens that are factory farmed under relatively inhumane conditions, that ratio can be much more impressive, closer to maybe 4 to 1. With crickets, it's actually 1.7 pounds of feed to 1 pound of protein. So it is a really true efficient converter of nutrition.
Still, did I just hear you say that you're feeding corn and chicken to crickets? Why don't we just eat the corn and chicken and cut the crickets out?
Well, so we're not feeding chicken to crickets. We're actually feeding them corn feed that is used in how chickens are fed. So it's the same kind of feed that chickens use. Yeah,
I see.
Because you're absolutely right. If that were the case, it would be circular.
So then you get the. So then you have these crickets, and then what do you do with them?
Mm-hmm. Excellent question. So, of course, we raise them in our facility here in Austin, and then what we do is we freeze them, which induces a sort of sleep-like state that makes the process of actually harvesting them painless. And then what we do is we roast them, and we either process them by flavoring them and position that as a ready-to-eat snack. So you can have, you know, any one of five different flavors of roasted Aketa crickets, which we've launched on our website. Or we actually pulverize them into a protein powder that is odorless and textureless and can basically be used in the same way that you would use whey or soy protein powders.
What do the crickets look like if I eat them whole? As crickets?
They're delegged and don't have any of the kind of animated features you would imagine when you think of a cricket. They're quite tasty, actually. We've conducted taste tests across the country, and people just keep going back for seconds and thirds.
So a delegged cricket is just the body of the cricket. It's like a little bean-shaped thing?
Exactly. I mean, it would look no different than, you know, you would grab a handful of sunflower seeds or almonds and so on, except instead of it requiring 1 gallon of water to produce a single almond, which it does, it takes less than a milliliter of water to produce one cricket.
And are they black?
Our crickets, so we farm the Aketa domestica species, which is far and wide considered the tastiest and sort of nicest in color.
I'll have to take your word for that, yeah.
It's a lot lighter in color, so it's not black. It's not like the crickets that we have here in Texas that sort of swarm in the in the summers. These are a very different species.
Since they've been roasted, when I bite into them, do I get a goop, or is it just kind of crunchy all the way through?
No, it's like it has the airy texture of popcorn, because the internal physiology of insects isn't like what most of us would think, so you're not going to get a, you know, mouthful of grossness. And mind you, I mean, you're talking to people who are ourselves. I mean, I didn't grow up eating insects, and that's how this process of learning about this phenomenon was a discovery for me, even though it existed around the world for millennia. But certainly it'll just taste like a very, airy and crispy popcorn or sunflower seed, except nothing gets stuck in your teeth.
Mohammed Asher's on a phone line. He's the founder and CEO of Aspire Foods. If you've heard about this, his drive is to feed the world with insects. We're already eating them. A lot of humans are. Why not all of us? It'll be healthier for us, and it'll be easier on all of the other things we're trying to do in this planet, like not overuse water, not raise snack foods in inhumane conditions, et cetera, et cetera. What is the biggest hurdle for you to overcome in order to make this a popular snack food in the United States?
I think definitely we have to approach this with a measure of humility and understanding that, you know, there is an ick factor that a lot of people have grown up not just with an unbiased view towards this product, but actually with a very negative bias towards insects, because understandably, in most of our lives, insects are either invaders or intruders or pests, or worse, even vectors of pathogens. So the first thing we have to do is we have to position the product with the consumer. And instead of saying to people to ignore their biological instincts that say, oh my gosh, no, don't do it, this is gross, instead of that, just understand that, you know what, you are right. Nobody's telling you to pick up an insect from the wild and eat it, because those really are truly gross. They eat totally unregulated feed, most of which, unfortunately, oftentimes is filth. They, of course, are not raised in sanitary conditions, et cetera, et cetera. What we're doing, however, is we're farming insects under the most sanitary and hygienic food safety standards in the United States, which has what is considered to be the highest standard of food safety, according to the FDA, than any other place in the world. So you're really approaching this in a very rigorous and scientific fashion. Not only that, but you're feeding them this organic certified feed that is, if I'm being very candid and honest, you know, healthier and cleaner than a lot of food that many Americans are consuming today. And finally, we're feeding them, or we're delivering to them, triple filtered water that is, more pure than a lot of the water that circulates in our own bodies. So frankly, when the consumer sort of understands that end-to-end supply chain and how transparently and humanely we raise this source of protein, it can help them, understand that this is very different from what they think of when they think of insects. But, of course, we still have some work to do. And ultimately, taste is king. So if the product doesn't taste fantastic, people are not going to buy it.
All right, we got a couple things to do then. I have to pause for a quick commercial break. Some of my listeners want to ask you a couple questions. Mohammed, will you give us another minute of your time?
Absolutely.
I'm also making a list of bugs I want to try. So I don't know if you've got a number two pencil and a clean piece of paper handy, but I just want to give you a couple of items you might want to throw in the hopper.
Yeah, go for it. And I like that pun.
What did I say?
The hopper.
Oh, gosh. See, that's it. I'm so gifted and talented, sometimes I don't even realize it. The number is 312-981-7200. Dave ate crickets. Dave, your experience. And I once ate a seven-course cicada dinner. There's something else I think would be kind of fun to try. In a minute, how about you? Mohammed Asher is on a phone line. His company sells bugs. He's the founder and CEO of Aspire Food Group. He wants you to eat packaged crickets. Before I just pick up a couple of phone lines, so how do I buy these things, Mohammed?
So you can go to our website, Aketta, AKETTA.com, and buy them. And actually, just for you, John, what we did for your listeners is if they use the coupon code WGN, they'll actually get 15% off their first purchase.
I want to try this. And actually, so you've got like a Southwest or a Tex-Mex or a ranch kind of flavoring on these things, right?
Yep. We have five different flavors right now, and we're constantly iterating. But these are absolutely delicious. We've gotten great feedback on the sea salt and vinegar, spicy hot, Texas barbecue.
Are they always crickets, Mohammed?
These are all crickets, yep.
Why not grasshoppers? I would eat grasshoppers.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, and so would I, and I have in Mexico. Grasshoppers, however, are a lot more challenging to farm than crickets, which makes them way more expensive to produce. So we're focusing on crickets for that reason.
I would eat ladybugs. Maybe you could do a medley. Are you interested in kind of a, like when I get my gummy bears, I have red ones and blue ones and green ones or Starburst. What about maybe a mixed bag?
Yeah, I think for now we're going to focus on crickets, and then down the road we'll potentially explore other options.
Pick up a couple of phone lines for our guest. Dave, you're on the air. What did you want to say? Hi.
John, it's your old buddy Dave from Porter County. I'm elated to have you back.
Dave, are you not a sheriff anymore, are you there, Dave?
No, I'm now teaching high school, of all things.
Boy, that's a tough teacher. I mean, this is a man who used to fire machine guns, kids, so you'd better behave, right, Dave?
Well, hey, listen, look who's talking. I mean, I was trying to explain to your lovely producer about your being a gun nut, too. But we digress.
Yes.
I called because this is the last thing I thought I'd be calling you on, John. But I actually tried some chips made from the, quote, cricket flour at the Flower and Garden Show on Navy Pier last month.
Wow. And how were they?
I got to say, I ate a couple of chips, and it was indistinguishable from flour. I mean, it was good. It was fine.
Dave, you described how you could make it into a powder and then a liquid, but are there baking opportunities? That would work, huh? Or Mohammed?
Yeah, I remember seeing...
Go ahead, Mohammed. Respond.
Yeah, absolutely, and thanks a lot for that remark. So actually, and I mentioned one of the things we do is we pulverize the crickets into a protein powder, and that's exactly one of the applications. So there's companies that use it as a protein powder in chips. There's companies that actually make cookies and brownies, and there's all sorts of protein bars in particular that are used as well and made across the country. There's a company called Chipul in South in Salt Lake City that actually specializes in making protein bars using cricket flour, too.
Huh, I'm out of time. Sheriff Dave, I'm always going to call you that. Now your teacher, Dave, thank you for calling. Joe wanted to know if you'd use Goliath beetles, but you're not going for the exotic or the gross or the adventurous. You're trying to make this a staple, aren't you, Mohammed?
Absolutely, John. I mean, we understand, of course, and mind you, I grew up here, so, you know, I watched very enthusiastically shows like Fear Factor where people are dared to, you know, swallow a whole cockroach and things of that sort, but we're not trying to prey on people's greatest fears, nor are we trying to position this as a gimmicky product. We're trying to position this as a very serious source of protein that is extraordinarily efficient for the body and the planet, and we want to be able to start by normalizing the insect people are most likely to find appetizing.
I'm going to order these. Everybody order these. We'll reconvene here in a week or two and give it a taste test. Go to Aketta, AKETTA.com, and the promo code is WGN. You'll save some money and who knows. I'll visit with you again, Mohammed. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, John.
Congratulations. Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis, what's coming up on your show today? You guys look laser focused.
Well, you know, times like this.
Anna's now laughing at the very notion of that.
But yeah, I think we do seem a little more serious. There's a lot going on.
Yes. Times like this call for it. I mean,
call for that tone.
I got slightly damp on my way to work today, and I have first world problems right here. I'm not.
Sure.
We just talked about feeding the poor with crickets, and you're going to complain about a little light rain.
I think my knees got wet. I don't know.
Oh, even your knees?
My knees. Oh. And I don't know. Was it the walking?
Horrifying.
It was horrifying. It was very. I know. Actually, take a lap is what my coach used to say to me. That didn't work out for him either. All right. We're going to start with Mark Sapelsa about this shooting of a judge on the South Side. Also, Mark McKinnon from The Circus is going to join us, talk about what's happening in Washington. And Mr. Skilling, all in the first hour. That's all you need to know right now.
I'll be listening, kids.